Selena Hoffman, I'm going to be listening in today.
This is Kelly Harnish. I'm listening in.
Any other online? Go ahead and introduce yourself. Not all at once. So let's go ahead and go around and introduce yourself.
Cindy Saunders.
Mike here, alternate for Bob Gear.
Ben Michael.
Ryan Washburn.
Matt Rasmussen.
AJ Olson.
Kyle Brown.
Brian Ace.
Becky Gross.
Jason Bliss.
Better, Matt Clark.
Monty Huber, alternate for Cheryl Frame.
Angie Vanarola.
You all received copies of minutes from December 8th. Any changes or corrections?
Motion to accept the minutes.
It's been a motion to accept the minutes. Second.
Second.
Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Carries. All right. This is a time for public comment. We do have some guests here this morning, or this afternoon, I should say. Any of you would like an opportunity to share, you also have public comment at the end as well. All right. So moving to discussion items, mental health work group has something they would like to share with us.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, and we had a discussion probably three meetings ago where a few of the groups reported out, this mental health group reported several programs that they thought would be of interest to the community. And so I know we haven't gone circle back to that, but I thought it might be important. And Cindy is online, freshen everybody what those ideas were, and then start to look at seeing if there's a consensus from this committee if we want to try to move forward with any of them. Some of them were, at least seemingly, were fairly easy and quick programs that could be stood up pretty soon and still have a tremendous benefit in the community. So Cindy, if you don't mind.
And so just a refresher, there were several of us that met together on the mental health subcommittee. And first we worked to identify what gaps there were in the community, what we would, if we had our dream wish and we could spend this money however we wanted, what were the things that we thought were most important for our community. And then the second time we met, we went through those items and made a priority list. And we made the priority list based on number one, kind of low hanging fruit. What are some of the things that we could implement first quickly? And then down to the things that would probably take longer and be harder to implement or just take more time. So the first one is a field responder program. This is very similar to the co-responder program that you all are familiar with. And we say field responder because we don't know what the stipulations around that would be. It would have to be an MHP and there'd be details to be worked out. But a field responder program, something we can get started right away to work with law enforcement officers or first responders. The second was respite or diversion beds. We need these for both youth and adults in our community, and that's something that we thought would be relatively easy or quick to stand up. The third was access to a prescriber on an urgent basis. We know that right now one of the biggest hurdles and barriers in our community is getting prescriptions, and so that was something we thought was really important. We thought maybe that could parallel with number one and two, and those are things we could work on together at the same time. The fourth was youth inpatient facility, children's long-term inpatient beds. Obviously, this is something that's going to be a lot longer process to put together. The fifth was an adult evaluation treatment center. The sixth was day treatment for both adults and youth. Seventh was eating disorder treatment. And then eight were things like partial hospitalization intensive outpatient with medication management for mental health, dialectical behavioral therapy, and transitional housing. So when Matt talked to me just briefly earlier, he said, let's talk about this, some of these things as a group, that maybe there's something that we could start getting going right now with the funding we have and the resources we have while we are working on the RFP and getting that going. So just that's just an overview if you have any questions about what some of those things are.
Clarify for me which of these would be facility based. They would need, I mean, obviously the respite and diversion beds, there needs to be a physical.
Yeah.
You just clarify those for some of these.
I think most of them would be facility based. Obviously, field responder program wouldn't necessarily have to be facility based. The prescriber wouldn't have to be, but the rest of them would be the diversion beds, the youth inpatient, the evaluation treatment, day treatment. All of the rest would have to have some facility that they're based out of.
Okay. Thanks.
But some of those, I mean, Brian, some of those, like the respite beds, from my understanding of looking at some programming, they need a facility, but it's not extensive. And essentially, it's a room for people to stay in if someone demands. And so we have a facility that we could choose a piece of that that probably wouldn't take a long time to retrofit space to have that happen. So, yeah, we wouldn't be able to stand it in a week or two, but it might be 6 months and it could be up.
And going along with that, and Kyle, I don't see Kyle here, but the county historically in the past, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, contracted this service to an agency and they would rent out an apartment and they would use that apartment as needed for respite beds. So it does need a place, but the options are more variable.
Yeah.
So that was kind of where I was, you know, I don't know if we want to try to take on all of them at the same time. You know, obviously the CLIP, the adult ENT, and those last three are pretty long term, and we may want to consider getting some of the stuff we're working at that's long term done, or at least to a point where it's almost done. But those first three really struck me as, hey, this doesn't seem like it would take very much to implement. Prescriber access, really, that's just a, probably a contract with somebody who's willing to have those services. So the field responder, that's getting with the local law enforcement groups and saying, is this valuable to you? What does it look like?
Matt, on the field responder, though, I think I just want to encourage, we have some dialogue about that. All it speaks for Kennewick that I think, well, at least Kennewick Police Department does not believe that the model with enforcement was the right. Just would want to give some consideration to how do they deploy.
Sure.
As we talk about it.
And that would be where we would, I think, this group or a representative from this group could engage with the law enforcement agencies. I don't want to say, we don't want to say, hey, this is, we want to do this. It's more of, do you want to do this? Mm-hmm. Have them guide us back on what should that look like and whether or not they find value in doing that. The answer is no, the answer is no, something else. But I think it's worth asking the question.
I think the answer is yes. It's just maybe not the police. Is it independent deployment? Is it, are you embedded with EMS? So it's just not independent deployment.
Sure.
Everybody wants something, we all see the need for something.
So that's that could be maybe a topic. I know we have the two sheriff's office meet monthly with the chiefs and sheriffs, and maybe that could be a question for the next, and it just met yesterday, I think. Yeah. But maybe next month, if one or both of you are willing to have your sheriff or have whoever your representative ask that question, at least start the dialogue between police and EMS agencies in this group. To come together and get a recommendation to take to the board, each board of commissioners, and say this is what we think it should happen. Maybe we have some funding idea of what it would take, and see if that's important to stand up. So what if the mental health group coordinating with CSL and EMS and to coordinate, you know, that to facilitate that conversation, what is deployment of this kind of program? Sounds like the chiefs and sheriffs probably meet right before this meeting, and so maybe we could have at least a we're interested in talking or something.
One of the things that when we're thinking about this, just to bring up, is the ASO did get funding from the state for a co-responder, and we've had a really hard time finding somebody to take that contract. It's very specific language, but one of the barriers I think is that the agencies that we're approaching or working with have a lot of questions or concerns about the individual being their employee. And so that's just one thing for the group to think about, is would the individual have to be an employee of the law enforcement or first responder, team, or would it be a contract position or something like that? Because we still have a co-responder contract we cannot get anyone to take. And that is for $100,000 a year. So that just gives you a little bit of an idea of how much it might cost to do something like this. For $100,000 a year, we had a college place contract with them, and they were not able to find anybody.
Do you require them to be an employee, or is it the opposite?
It requires that they are an employee. It requires that they're an MHP, which, if that's one of the good things about this group deciding the requirements, it doesn't have to be an MHP if you don't want it to be. And then the actual agency that was hiring had some expectations that they would pass a lie detector test, of course, and that they had other things. So they just were not able to find somebody for the $100,000 a year that they were willing to take on as an employee and keep at risk for the method qualifications. So just keep that in mind. But this is a very strict contract from legislation, and we could develop ours however we want it to be.
Just to clarify, are you saying that an employee of the county or an employee of the agency?
The agency. That's how our contract is written. And that is a barrier. So that's just one thing to think about. Like, you, I don't know if you guys would feel comfortable hiring a person and having them be your staff, or if you'd want a contracted position. It's just something to think about.
But if we did it, we could offer them that option.
Yeah,
be a contracted position. So it saves a lot of overhead when it comes to benefits. So
Matt, I can't help but think back to when we went down to Pierre, Arizona, where up to Tempe, is that where we were?
Yeah.
The models that they've got down there that the counties have already implemented, if we could get our hands on how their model works down there, I think that's the biggest thing that we're up against here, is that from the county sheriff's offices to the police departments, the fire departments, I mean, it's, in theory, it's a great idea, but how do you actually implement it and put it together and make it work? And I think both of those models that we looked at down in Arizona, they're absolutely great. I mean, they're completely standalone, if you will. The calls come into the 911 dispatch. These field responders go out first. Of course, the sheriffs and the police are on standby if they need them. But 9 times out of 10, those field responders are able to handle all of that. But of course, eliminating the time and the responses from the police agencies.
I think, Jason, that's really what we're after, is to try to take some of the system, right, that we really want to co-respond. We really are able to deal with it, and I'm not being in comments as early as well, trying to get at.
You're talking, we have comprehensive, currently has a mobile crisis response team that is not embedded.
Yeah, but I think there was like 30-minute response time, right, though, too. And so a lot of it, you know, it can get a faster response time because people are going to become impatient and want somebody to get there relatively quick. And if they don't, that's going to generate a minute.
So, Cindy, how many of the services that you just listed are wrapped up under the RFP?
All of them, as far as I understand, we can provide all of them under the RFP. Is that right?
The RFP is specific to the crisis. Crisis of the residential inpatient.
Okay.
This would be a different.
So the extra things would just be extra, I guess.
Right. We'd have to look at different solicitations for them, but some of these are fairly small. If obviously, if there were a co-responder or a separate responder to the communities, and you know, engaging the law enforcement in the evidence to make sure what do you feel is valuable. We had talked a while ago about the possibility of maybe just working with intensive and saying let's expand the program you have to get the faster response times and pay for that. But to me, the conversation really needs to start with the agency and say what is valuable to you guys, because we've got dispatch that's impacted by that and all the various agencies, and make sure we know what everybody wants, and then come back with a proposal for the commissioners. The other one, the respite diversion beds and the prescriber access, we'll just focus on those three. Those are just finding a provider, and you know, the counties don't necessarily have to go through a lengthy formal selection process to provide services. We can just get a short list real quick and pick somebody. So, you know, smaller contracts, that's a lot more favorable. Big contracts for hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, we usually like to have a more formal process, and some of these smaller ones we could just get a short list and say, these are the people who are interested.
And run that through human services or direct to the county or to make sure the partners and issues are happening. Sorry.
It, you know, it just depends.
Well, I think there would be something that we talked about previously. I think that it's a real concern is with referral times. You know, if we're looking at a prescriber, yeah, they're going to be able to see X amount of people, but then if it takes 6 months to get them into one of the agencies, then that's going to limit the capacity that they're going to have. So you know, I think it's just a matter of, you know, how we want
a resource that leads to nowhere.
Some sort of a bridge.
And I think that is one of the things we said on the prescriber is that it would only be interim. So it would be somebody who's waiting to get in to see somebody and they would only see them during that short time, not forever.
Yeah, I could see how that that list would build up.
Exactly.
What is anyone know what, you know, if I were to try and schedule a medication appointment at one of the providers, how long is the way? Upwards of 6 months?
Especially for
3 months.
Yeah. So that will limit their ability. Yeah.
What about, have we explored vendors that do telehealth for behavioral health prescribing? Like having a contract with a vendor to do that bridge work?
No, we haven't, but that's exactly what this could be. That's a really great
idea. Just like connecting with the vendor because.
Yeah. I remember something about telehealth.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
Yes, and there's, I have access to some of that information in my work, so I can also do some digging in. And there's some good social media based texting support that goes on that could bridge them until they see that face to face interaction.
Have you got some ideas that share them with the group and see if you come up with something? That...
So even if those services are something that where we grant this RFP to and want to wrap into their contract, is there any harm in starting it? I mean, because we're looking at quite a timeline here before we can get that up and going, at least for year to year contract.
Yeah, I don't see any harm.
I think that would be great. And then I would just going off of that, how would people know about it? Right? It would be like, how do we get the word out that we have this person available to see people on weeks? So that's a
communications.
Yeah, exactly.
That's more. I don't know how comprehensive would feel about it. But letting comprehensive know this is available, but comprehensive also has prescribers, but it would only be an interim. You can't get someone in to see a prescriber anyways. So I don't see why they wouldn't.
Right.
Well, I think the mobile outreach teams, and the crisis, maybe they're one and the same, maybe they're separate entities, but I mean, those are going to be the people that are going to be the people in crisis that need that immediate appointment. So that would make the most sense that they would probably.
We have a mental health participant right now. Problems trying to get treatments and housing to drivers. She ends up going back into jail where they get her stabilized. She decompensated because it took a few days. I've been able to.
I think that's where transitional housing happens on the front end and the tail end, right? It's not just once they're well. We need some sort of a friend.
So, yeah, I mean, these are things that I'm thinking about. So, I'm looking for some people, maybe from this group, who are willing to take a look at those and come up with an idea. And I'm certainly willing to help and with the contracting process, but I need indication on what like.
Can I ask you a couple questions? First one, just to get a better
understanding,
Chief, this may go to you because you spoke. So on that field responder program, one of the concerns was the 30-minute delay What would be the right response? Like, I'm just trying to understand how much that needs to tick down, because that's going to be an economics issue of sure. To do that. You have to have multiple people in close proximity.
I don't know.
Okay. Do you guys converse on that and maybe bring that back?
I think we can. Today is. So I don't sure what. Vision that they would. Dispersed throughout the region.
And so what, that's what we saw down in essentially remote, not really proximity's house, but they were stationed dispatch for getting.
I think it'd be helpful just to get an idea on that, if we can get that reported back. And then I guess my other question on that one is, I heard two different scenarios, one 911, but then it goes to a field responder instead of to law enforcement. The other I heard was it bypasses 911. Is there really a standard on whether it's a 911 call or whether it passes the 911?
Yeah,
here we go.
First thing right. That they do is call 911.
Okay.
But I think what makes the difference is if the 911 dispatchers, it would be amazing if they could just dispatch to those
right.
Field responder units. Yep. That if the field responders, they've got radios too, they could have law enforcement there in a short yep. Period of time if they needed it. There's not a need to co respond.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Question: the program that's down in, were they government employees or were they? Contract?
If I recall correctly, one was county and the other was a private entity.
That's right.
Because the first one was RI and then the second one was Connections, who was contracted with the county.
Yeah, yeah,
Connections, right. Who was contracted, yeah, subcontractor of the county.
I'm on a national committee writing standards for 911 centers for alternative response and correspondent models right now. Share some of the information that we've gathered. One thing I was thinking when you guys were talking is kind of hybrid of some of these things that they're starting to do best a little bit, which is in smaller communities where they can't actually send people out into the field as quickly as they like. They use traditional response, either law enforcement or fire EMS, and then they take their mobile data terminals into wherever the person is and they start a teleconference with somebody. So there's a lot of different options, I think. Variables to kind of get where gaps to. This is what I was going to say. Kim and I are looking at each other across the room because I know in some communities the 911 dispatcher, if it's not an emergency, they can transfer to a nurse triage line, maybe it would be a behavioral health triage line in this case, who can then de-escalate, do some screening, filtering. Is this something where I need somebody within 10 minutes or is this something I can wait the 30 minutes? So there's like this additional level of triage. And I know that there are services that you can contract with for those. Do you know anything like that, Kim?
I've heard of models that I don't really locally, but I can certainly look at it.
Regard to that. Cindy, what's 988?
Yeah.
I mean, that's essentially what 988 does, right?
But I was going to ask him if you've seen any difference in calls since 988 has rolled out. If people are calling 988 or if they're still calling 911, because if they were calling 988 instead, I guess you wouldn't hear about those. They would go to the regional crisis line instead.
Yeah, in Washington State, 988 is there for suicide prevention and other people can call any of those things. It is not meant to be a dispatcher or a secondary source to get additional assistance. It's just a telephone conversation with someone. So oftentimes when 988 gets phone call from somebody, they feel needs a response, they will then call us and relay the information. There's not a technical way for them to transfer that call to 911 for us. Sometimes they can transfer it to our non-emergency. So there's a lot of things that are kind of working on challenges that they don't have location information of someone. So they're in a situation where they don't know where they're calling, except that they're probably, it's not even based on geography, it's based on the prefix of your phone number, your area code is how the calls. So if you could have purchased a cell phone in the city of Pennsylvania, and if you call 988, it's going to come here. that takes a lot of time and coordination to kind of. Is there a converse situation where 911 would get a call that you, I mean, yeah, is it always that level of response, or is it the dispatchers can triage and say this is actually appropriate for 988?
You can transfer direct.
988, we cannot transfer direct for 988. We can send it to a 7-digit number, and we're working toward technologies that will allow us to do this. But they're just not developed yet in the media. So there are options for other ways of transferring calls, and we do currently do a certain level screen to make sure that they don't have a lot of money, they don't have a prior EMS, they're having a behavioral issue. Oftentimes they'll tell us that I haven't taken my meds in this long and I'm having challenges, and they'll identify what those are and to crisis response. Question.
Do you have data that looks at the purpose of the call and the outcome of each of those calls so that we can kind of target, like, are these SD issues? Are these, you know, psychosis? Are these, you know?
Yeah. That's one of the things we're talking about, subcommittee, and gathering data that I can meet for. Now we have event types. And some of our agencies, specifically Pasco Police Department, identifies the call. To change the event type basically to something that's more meaningful data collection. I think that as we move forward, we need to look at that and find ways to capture that data so that we can start to analyze it and make plans more focused on those issues, but currently we don't really have it.
So we don't know a number of calls for behavioral health issues yet at this time.
Yeah. None of that data goes through Census, or is it only when
we put information in for every medical call, but it doesn't get down to that granular where it's defined that this is being remote.
And I just want to just make a comment on, so we have data for crisis calls that come into the like the regional crisis line and 988 for our region, but not calls related to 911. So we have a portion of the data, but not either.
Identified as specifically health, because you have a disturbance where people are fighting, and then law enforcement gets on scene and they determine that it's because of a behavioral health issue. It's not going to change the overall event type for us. Disposition to work. There are secondary ways that we can capture that data should we choose to, and develop some standards where everybody's kind of using the same thing.
In the communities that are dispatching crisis teams, what is the protocol or standard operator to determine that? That seems like a pretty high responsibility.
Yeah, most of them have triage. So what they do is they identify if there is a threat to the community or to the person themselves, and then they kind of triage down from there. I'll say that LA County has a really good triage program for 911 scene analysis we're doing. That pretty gets you there pretty quickly, because you want to get really quickly,
sure,
identify whether or not this is a priority incident. We need to send traditional response or something that could. And then the better programs that I've seen have a real good relationship with who they're passing those off to. So if they get in the conversation and now all of a sudden it becomes a disturbance or something where they need to have law enforcement, there's this communication back and forth. In some comp centers, that's within the same building, they have behavioral health specialists embedded in the call center and the 911 center. That's not very common, but there are some that do that, so they can pass the call back and forth. Sometimes they're in a different facility and they transfer the calls or the information, relay the information. Sometimes they're tied together electronically through a CAD system, the computer dispatch system. So I could start a call, ship it off to them, they would take over the phone call, but then I could look and see if they updated any information that would indicate anything differently and take it back. There's a lot of different methods. And that's kind of what we're doing here as a committee, as we're going through and looking for best practices to try to make some kind of a standard.
If you had resources, money for doing something like that, would that speed that process along? Because I think what you're describing there makes a lot of sense in terms of the having somebody that has behavioral health training in the building that you can pass calls off to. Makes sense. operators, that's a kind of a, that's a niche, right? That's a specialty that has a potentially has a different skill set than somebody who's a crisis mental health worker. And the last thing I want to do is sending a mental health worker into a dangerous situation because they didn't know what they were doing. Disastrous. So, and I'm not saying that to be alarmist, but I mean, that's realistic. But if it was in the same, you know, in the same call center, had somebody that was on, I don't know if that makes sense or not, but just me talking out loud.
There's a lot of different options. Every one of them needs to be looked at. Some of the challenges we're seeing are in very big municipal departments, it's staff 24/7.
Sure.
And it's almost hard to have a process where between Monday and Friday, 8 to 5, we do it this way, but between 8 and 9, we do it this way, and whatever, that's where we lose things. So whatever it is that the community ends up with as a way of addressing this, I would like to see it be as consistent as possible, just because we don't have these gaps. That's where you make mistakes and where things are lost.
There is another idea that comes to mind. What if we find a way to get crisis response some more funding, and that when those calls come in, that 7-digit transfer that you can do goes right back to crisis response. They've got, they're better staffed, better equipped to be able to handle those calls and dispatch their own DSRs or mental health first aid responders. I think maybe the mechanism's there already, just beef it up.
Has there become any, from a liability standpoint, if decision is made wrong and it goes to crisis and maybe law enforcement needed to be there. So I don't, that's too far in the weeds, but.
Sure, that's where there's a lot of discussion about having those good relationships where we identify with, based on what we know right now, this is not a response that requires traditional law enforcement or EMS. So we're gonna pass it on to you. Should that change? You need to pass it back. And I think those cues are pretty.
Sure.
So I think there's always liability, but I think it's fairly limited.
We do that to NEMO too already, because yeah. Fire goes out, and if you have a sense that this is not safe, we don't go in. So that one over.
On this, and maybe I'll just throw this out there and see what everybody thinks. Maybe step is we have our representatives, maybe our fire, and let's take it back to their various groups and say, okay, this is the discussion we're having. What's the preferences of the groups? Do we want a co-responder model, field responder model? What, and get some ideas of what those two groups, because they're the biggest impacted, that come back to this committee and say, okay, here's what we have, here's what they can report back, here's what we've got. So we want Kim and the dispatch center, make sure that how that works together. But at least that gets this conversation going in the right direction. It sounds like everybody's in agreement that something needs to be done here. Let's figure out what the benefits law enforcement and EMS the most, and start down the road. So I don't have a quick email chain, say here's kind of what we talked about. If the four of you guys would be willing, or relay it to whoever's going to those meetings and say, hey, feedback from our groups here, so we can, hopefully the end goal is to benefit all of you guys. I mean, that's really what that type of model benefits law enforcement and EMS the most. And sure we do it. But can we at least start with that and start making some progress on it? So,
could we also,
and Mike will tell Bob that he's got to do
We also asked somebody that was part of that Arizona trip to reach out if they've got a logic map, if they've got a contract, because it sounds like you've seen two successful models.
Jamie, it'd be Jamie great probably to, has yeah. something. We could get something from our eye, I'm sure.
That'd be great.
So, and I might be able, I got a contact over at Connections Health, which is the other one, and I can ask her if. On the next one, I mean, I'm just going to go through these top three and see where we can go. The respite diversion beds. It sounds like the counties through Human Services used to have a program.
Yeah, we had a, it was a needing diversion bed. And so we'd had a contract, this was years ago, I think, I didn't before you were a crisis, but Gordon was there and we had, and quite frankly, it was full a lot of time. We had a contract with TCRS to staff up to two diversion beds for someone with developmental disability. And it was a hospital diversion, and it was in an apartment complex. They rented an apartment, staffed it when it was full, and it was a really good resource. I think Matt and I've talked, and some others in the group, and there is space that probably fairly easily could be converted into something like that. I know we, you know, I don't know if we still do, but there were youth diversion beds and just general mental health diversion beds that I think probably all three are needed.
But, just, you know, after I've been walking KGH, I mean, we did all the tours and stuff, but I've gone back over there and just kind of walked around, and as you're walking through there, I've noticed some areas that were probably some kind of special service or something, but they have their own entrance. There are a couple of offices and lobby. Thing ahead, that's what got me to want to spur this conversation back up. And I was like, hey, group thought diversion beds, we could take these three or four offices, section them off real quick from the rest of the building, fix the HVAC and electrical in there, and we could have that been running before the end of this year. So that's why that's something that we want to explore. Adam, Kyle, I don't know, you may have your connections, or maybe we could make Gordon do it since he's been around.
I like that. I can connect with Gordon.
If there's somebody, at least, you know, maybe on between the two of you guys, if we could reach out to some of those providers in the area and get a conversation going about, okay, we're thinking about that, assuming the committee here all agrees, we're thinking about this, and what does that look like? What kind of space do you need? And how much do we expect this would cost? And be able to report back to here and say, okay, here's what we got to make this real. Do we want to make a recommendation to the commissioners?
It would be nice to have the diversion beds be the hard to place populations, to mention the Alzheimer's, autism, DDs for the developmental disabilities. Those are the populations that get in that limbo area where psych hospitals are saying, what are we going to do? We can't fix, meds aren't going to fix the developmental disability. And so we're not taking them. It's a placement issue. And then the first responders have over and over contact. And so everybody kind of points fingers. Is it DDA's issue? Is it the state's issue? Is it a private issue? Yeah. So it'd be nice if we did diversion beds specifically for those populations.
I know.
So, historically, with the specialized foster parents, to utilize those beds with people that already been trained in dealing with issues, so we can kind of look further out. And I know. Back in the day, we had looked into partnering with Alzheimer dementia units, assisted living facilities, where they would hold a bed for that type of diversion effort versus, you know, using a space at the Auburn campus. I mean, there's lots of options.
Lots of options. But maybe that's
just the money part.
But I mean, we're all paying a little bit of sales tax every time we go buy something. So there's money out there, and if these are things that would make what, I mean, Gordon, do you guys mind exploring some options and bringing something back and saying, here's what, and then Cameron, you want to, what the need is, here's who can provide those, here are the options to have the space.
Yeah, because I think it would not be one provider doing all.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, I like the idea of renting a, you know, for an old timers type or that type of thing in a facility that already cares for them. That makes a lot more sense than trying to set something up.
There's so much set up for isolation protocols and stuff. Right. You know, post-COVID, there may be some places.
And then the youth one, that makes total sense too. If there's people out there who are willing to do it and just lack a little bit of funds to make it happen, then why would we not take advantage of that?
Do you still have that contract by chance? Look at that and build off
of that. Yeah, I'll
scratch.
And then the last one is
hold on a second. Before we get too far along, there's potentially two motions that we need to make as a committee, or we want to, just because if we don't make a motion, we aren't doing it. So the first motion would be for the law enforcement EMS representatives to go back to their constituents and determine what sort of crisis services would be most beneficial for them and report back to the committee. Happy to entertain a motion that would say something like that.
So motion. So she doesn't have to call again.
Entertain a second.
Second.
All in favor, say aye. Opposed? Okay, and the second motion would be to have the county health
services.
Human services, sorry. For the possibility of crisis beds and what necessary details would be involved in that. Entertain a motion like that. Sorry for my technical language.
So good.
Second.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Well, great, thank you. Appreciate your. One is the prescriber access, and so I guess somebody in the group who would be willing to take that on a little bit to see what options are, what the needs are, what the options are, and come back next month.
It could be the month after, but I think I like Becky's idea about looking telemedicine providers.
Yeah.
Because those providers will already have contracts with all of the payers, and so there won't be any need to do that.
I can do that. I can dig in to see what kind of vendors are available.
So we're looking for the same motion for that.
Same motion that Becky's going to take a look at possible telehealth providers, other providers that can be prescribers on a contract basis.
So motion.
Second.
We both seconded.
Yeah. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Awesome. I have a question about that, Matt, since Joelle brought this point up of payers. If the run into a situation where somebody is on that list and they don't have any coverage at all, they're non-Medicaid, they're state only, is the county going to cover the cost of?
Cover the cost of
the
appointment, I guess.
But not any medication or.
Yeah, I think that needs to be part of our recommendation to the commissioners. Which direction should go? Both sides who need to decide.
Yeah.
Do we want to pay for that, or do we? That's really where this committee really needs to forward and say. Committee says. It's important that we cover those costs because a lot of people fall through the cracks because of that. I think that is part of our recommendation.
I think, again, I brought this up before, but a population to look at is the undocumented medication. They don't have the services, so they end up in jail a lot or detained hospitals. So, yeah, a lot of money.
Sure. And that's the goal. That's what I think. Yeah. We think that's important. That is boards.
This is Erin Petty. I'm sorry, I'm calling in, but I'd love to interject with we need to acknowledge that the population that we will be dealing with has no coverage. So it's just, I'm here hearing that we acknowledge that and we try to make some type of consolation with that population of people.
Thank you, Erin.
Cindy, do you have, it would be helpful, if that is a recommendation, knowing how big of an issue that is to formulate a budget.
Mm-hmm. I could get numbers on how many non-Medicaid state-only individuals that we would be asking for services, but not for the undocumented, because they wouldn't be asking, we wouldn't pay for it, we can't use state-only funding for that. The MCOs can't use their funding for that, so it's just kind of a data point that's not gathered.
Okay.
But we might be able to get some information from jails on how people are in jail, but it would be difficult to get data on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. And if we're truly using the no wrong door, I think that, that we really need to put that at the forefront if we're going to use the no wrong door motto.
Yeah.
I know just our commissioners have said, at least on our side, have said that they would like to make sure they covered that first 24 hours of care for whoever doesn't have another day. And so that's something. Mm-hmm. All that at one of the facilities in Arizona, as that was their role, it's basically the county. Mm-hmm. We'll pay for the first day of stay for everyone, regardless. And so.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
We also have to be cognizant of the resources and unlimited, and so there may have to be a cap because we want to be able to provide a lot of programs. So that just needs to be a discussion. Yeah, unfortunately, probably not a lot of data. I can ask jail command staff if they have any data on people who undocumented people who come in and require that. And at least we may not get 100%, but we might be able to get a rough estimate of what we think that.
And so great. Collect our own data where we do a quarter, we run a quarter, and then at the end of the quarter, we bring back the numbers of how much we're actually spending and then adjust from there.
Right. Back when I get into the office on that, but I thought there's a law that just passed that in 2024, undocumented individuals would be eligible for Medicaid and for insurance through the exchange.
I believe you're correct.
Are there any providers that are working with behavioral health undocumented workers that may have at least, I don't know, anecdotal information or data, or, you know, so that we're not just shooting in the dark, really? I mean, I don't know if there's any providers that.
What about Grace Clinic?
I was going to say Grace
Clinic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, just that maybe they could give us some more insight than we have collectively around this table, which is a lot, by the way, but I think that it's sort of like, what is the problem there?
I think honestly, it might just be Grace Clinic because all of our providers survive on Medicaid funding, and if Medicaid doesn't pay for undocumented, they can't.
Yeah. The clinics.
Yeah, it'd be worth a call on both of the jails, because they. Sad but true, but our jails are our defunct mental health treatment providers right now. Sales, they wind up getting a whole lot.
What would be the question we'd ask the jails? What data would we need?
I guess the undocumented ones that come in with behavioral health or eating.
Like number of jail days attributed to.
It's a number. I don't know about jail days because it's.
Just as unique.
And I think also how many of them potentially are starting on psychiatric medication stay?
Well, we could probably get that from the behavioral health contracted provider for the jails, right?
Mm-hmm.
The jail starts anyone on psychiatric? Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Would they start someone on a prescription if they knew, if, say, they weren't in there for a long term and they knew they weren't going to be receiving medication?
Question for homes.
Yeah. Right.
If they're thinking through that, probably depends on the situation, how cute.
Josh follows that stuff pretty closely. I can ask him that question. He's put together old ones. That's great. I mean, start working on those three and see how far we can get. See if we can get the commissioners to appreciate everyone's conversation.
Yeah, let me ask a question. That list was created by the mental health subgroup, and you know, we have an SUD subgroup. So I'm just wondering, do we need a separate wish list? Are some of those services for co-occurring patients, or how are we looking at this?
My opinion, this is not the answer maybe for everyone, but I think we should have either your list that you've created join in with our priority list, start working on the priorities as we can. A
lot of these are going to be people with quote brain disorders, but separating them out is going to be pretty difficult. Just together and start working on them.
Okay, well, we'll get together and
okay.
come up with a wish list. Yeah.
Yeah, the thing we talked about here impact both.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we just need to be clear that's not just mental health intervention.
It's behavioral health.
Behavioral
health.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
All right. Moving on to the next discussion item, update on the RFP.
So I took back the right sent out that the commissioners had agreed with the recommendation of the committee. Reject the one proposal that we had received and then revise the RFP. So I worked on that and sent it out to the group. I received a couple of comments back, nothing major, because if you want your little typos. So I just wanted to let everyone know I'm prepared to send that out on Tuesday. Just kind of want to get through the holiday and have it Tuesday morning. Just want to give everything a chance. You kind of responded. You didn't send me an email if there's anything that you wanted to bring up here, if I need to change anything or concerns. Otherwise, I'll just move forward with reissuing it on Tuesday. And I may add, there's a few people here who I may reach out to and say, hey, can you help me develop a list? Like either cold call or cold email, just a lot of different providers.
What? Bless me.
I've got to let Michelle sent me a big list of residential substance use providers. So I think we'll try to contact them and just let them know that it's available. And
yeah, I just wanted to clarify, I'm an alternate. That's why I'm on the public comment section. So, but were we going to include or was there discussion about including T and the green facility as well? Some conversation about
that's what I was going to
bring up. And great thing, HMN and ENT, so that if somebody came in and it's acutely psychotic and needed to be detained, they can just go right to the ENT. So it would truly be a one-stop shop, mm-hmm. no locked door. Now, if it's an involuntary crisis stabilization facility, they can be held there as long as there is a bed at an ENT somewhere that in an admission date. So there's a little bit of wiggle room there, but I was just curious before you send it out that the ENT at that same facility is not responsible.
My understanding of it was, and that is something that needs to be clarified in there, is that if it's an ENT and licensed as an ENT, it can operate as a crisis stabilization facility too, both.
So did it call out an ENT in the RFP?
It specifically does. So we want to say that it's a crisis stabilization unit under an ENT license. Just call it an evaluation and treatment facility.
So you said if it's a crisis stabilization license, you can have an ENT under that license.
The ENT license can do the CSU program, but not the other one. Just have this. The other one is the triage. It can't do the stuff that the ENT can do. The ENT can do the stuff the CSU can do, but not the other way around.
Right. So would we be limiting ourselves if we didn't?
The intent was, at least, I probably didn't articulate it clearly, that the goal was to have it be licensed as an ENT. So I would change that.
Yeah, that's
that's just that's one line in the thing, crisis stabilization unit as an ENT. So I'll clarify that. Yeah, that was the thought, is that we would want to have it the higher license so we can do both things. Yeah, we wouldn't want to limit ourselves.
Yeah, I think we were kind of just reading it that ENT was like taken out of it.
So, okay.
Just to save time, I just would want to encourage you to double check the difference between a license and a certification. Most facilities are licensed as a resident treatment facility and certified to do multiple things. So what you're probably looking for is a residential treatment facility that is then certified to do evaluation and treatment services.
right, join our committee.
But I just want to wait till the very end to say that.
Maybe you can get somebody to select you as an alternate.
Jeez. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, I actually had one, I wanted to add a discussion item, if that's okay with the committee. I know that several of you visited sites, and I think it would be good just to kind of have a general discussion of how those visits went and your impressions.
I was super excited. I thought they were great. The Bruno building was way bigger than I thought it would be. There's so much potential there. And then KGH, I was expecting it to look way worse than it did, just from some of the things I've heard. And there's so much space there, and I was actually really excited walking around imagining all of the things that we could do there. There's just so much potential. So I felt it was really great.
I second what she said.
Yeah, we're together.
Just report on the KGH, we've invested some money in boarding up all of the accessible windows and fire department to try to get that secured, so that right now we don't have a heating system, and that's caused damage to the fire sprinkler system. So we're trying to work through getting them satisfied that that's kind of work. But boarding up all the windows has significantly cut down on the damage that's been caused, so that we're not seeing the break-ins anymore. We had a little bit of graffiti on the outside of the building last week, but that's been the extent of it for the last couple of weeks. So it's not getting worse. We're kind of now status quo. We're going to look at bringing in some full-time facilities people to be out there for at least a couple of years. And the first thing that we want them to do is start fixing all the water systems, getting heat functioning at least a minimal level, and starting to clean out the building, cleaned up and ready. So that as we start bringing in these programs, you know, the rest of the building that's going to remain vacant, because it's going to take years to develop the whole thing. But so that's where we're at. So it's some good news on that, the front of damage is being mitigated now. So
any other comments?
I was just curious, as we start to clean up, you know, the hospital campus, get that ready, are we able to sublease any of that space now for providers that will ultimately be there as partner agencies? I'm just curious.
I mean, we can lease it out. I mean, and that all of these different way these programs are contemplated is it would be a lease. So the providers would pay a lease, set the amount to be fairly nominal, basically just enough that we would be able to cover the major building systems maintenance. We're not trying to make money on it. Keep the roof up and the walls fixed. And so yeah, that's definitely an option. Talked about went for recovery housing and leasing some of that out, the respite beds. I would envision that being very similar to kind of how it was before, is we would lease the space. Now, they wouldn't be paying market apartment rent. They'd be paying a very low cost lease, to them, again, just enough for us to keep the HVAC system on. So that's the goal. That's at least the way county's envisioning is going. We're going to lease it out. And there's going to be space for outpatient providers if we want to add people interested in doing outpatient clinic there of some kind. They could simply approach the county. And we just haven't gotten to that point where we started to outreach for that. My focus has obviously been trying to get the main recovery center components going first and then move to someone else. Someone approached us and said, hey, I want to start up this clinic and I need space, that would be something I think we'd bring back to this committee and say, do we want to provide space for that type of program? Does that have value?
Yeah, we could start getting that to be the hub, you know, the hub where those services are going to reside. The more, you know, the earlier we can start,
That's ultimately why the decision was made by, you know, the county, even with the 72-hour restriction on mental health. That's ultimately why we bought the building anyways, because we recognize that there's so much need that isn't impacted by that, that why wouldn't we buy it and provide that hub for all of these types of services? Yeah, it'd be great to have one place where people can go and get almost everything they need. And we've got some other services. You've got the recovery cafe that is open right across the street. And the more of those things we bring in, I think the more of those things are going to come down to that area too.
So I think my only, I love the thought of that. And it's really hard to be sitting here not having something to offer this point as we wait for the RFP to come back. But I guess my concern is if we do too much, then it limits a blank slate option, which is the purpose of doing the RFP for the providers. They can be part of that design process, right? And so I guess that's the only caution I give to that is I love that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need to be cautious, yeah, whatever that
purposeful.
Very yeah. much so, because if we piece it up too much, then it's no longer a blank slate and it's going to make design very difficult to make it work.
Same thing, Brian, too, that really could come and give an answer.
I think one of the things that I had envisioned anyway, we're going to have to start working towards choosing we're going to do this under a design build process. So we've talked with the capital projects advisory group, which is the state board. I forget the exact acronym for it, but sounds like CPARP. Yeah, there you go. They're going to allow us to submit it as a project over the entire life of the development of the facility. So we'd have one design build team to do all of the individual pieces. So up front, we would probably ask that team to say, okay, let's get a master plan done. What are the individual spaces? What do we think should go where? And that way, we have that opportunity. And then we don't end up with this, oh, we should have put this over here.
Right.
Because now it hinders our ability to do this. And we thought through that up front and made those decisions. That's a great point.
I'm just thinking of the outlying buildings.
Yes.
More so than the hospital itself. Right. It was office, that office.
Anyone else that did the visits, positive or negative impressions, feedback?
I thought it was great. Thanks for taking this.
Absolutely. Anytime.
I don't know if this is a motion per se, but I know that some of the conversations there was at least some reluctance on, you know, nature of the two locations and how what the implications of that are, what it looks like to the community and whatnot. Is anybody on the committee have any reservations with those two locations? I think it'd be good to just, like, if there are reservations, it'd be good to get that out open now. If not, then, like, can we just say that the committee is on board with this too? I don't know if that's a motion or it should be a motion, but.
Do we need to maybe have like a town hall sort of meeting? Public information, voice their opinion?
Hey, what do we do with that though? Because the, you know, as far as the materials facility has been purchased,
mm-hmm.
And so that, sure. That's a done deal.
The lease
has been signed. Yeah. So is that buying trouble?
That's exactly.
I just want the committee to be going in the same direction rather than what's about we have our meeting debating whether we.
Kind of past the point of return.
Yeah. I mean, I would have loved for everything to be in one spot.
Yeah, me too.
That would have been my dream, but it is what it is. So
working around as best we can.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think Kyle done a pretty spectacular job. As soon as the guys found out that we couldn't do metal out there in 72 hours, jumped on and started networking. But he was the Bruno building. Up and said, yeah, you probably do something like that. So it seemed pretty seamless, like almost like it was planned.
And the bottom line is the service that we desperately need to have. The general public is in favor of having services rather than services.
And I think proximity too. I mean, if you're going to have to be in two locations, which is the reality based on the trio's limitations, it's better to be close, right?
That was one of the hardest parts about finding the second location is we didn't want it to be 10 miles away,
right.
To be within a few minute drive.
And good access to both counties.
But we didn't want to far south end to Franklin County an extra 30 minutes to get there. That's not reasonable.
And I think all the one-stop, the crisis services are going to be at one location. So law enforcement will, it won't, I don't believe will be impacted by that. You know, some of the other services that our community is lacking maybe aren't on that. You know, it's not a place where law enforcement is going to drop somebody off at a residential as you used to treat. And so those can be coordinated with the people that are, you know, with staff at the drop-off center. And that's a person, by the time they go to residential SUD or any of the other services provided there, that crisis will at least not be in the immediate stage, and they can put the car in, so like I said, drive a couple minutes down the road. So,
and that is the way the RFP is crafted, is those crisis services, 23-hour observation, and crisis stabilization, EMT, secure withdrawal management, detox, those need to be in the same facility. We don't have to say, oh, I got to go here with this guy or here with this guy. So you're going here, they'll take it from there. It's the way it's written, that's exactly that's what we want.
So initially, all of us wanted it in one spot, and that was the goal. But I think now that it's this way, I think it actually the long run might be better, because it gives us an opportunity to provide so many more services than we initially would have been able to. And as Department of Commerce grants come out and you guys keep applying for grants, you know, the possibilities are endless of how many services we could provide with these two buildings. Whereas if we only stop with one, we might have to turn down some opportunities.
Well, we got the wall is rolling very well with the state and the Department of Commerce, and more money we bring in and the more of these we start to stand up, the more money they're going to throw out. Not only will it benefit our regions, I mean, if we build out all the things that we've talked about here, this will become a statewide hub for behavioral health services. That possibility, and the state is very excited about possibility.
Thank you guys for the discussion.
I don't want to open to make the camera, but there's been various different chatter between both counties. Are both sets of commissioners, I guess, still invested in working together for the greater good for both of these facilities? I mean, I remember when it originally came up, we attended the meetings over in Franklin County when they worked on 1/10 of 1% and just popped around for the recovery center. It was all good. It was going in a positive direction. It was going good in a positive direction. Benton County, and I'm just hoping for all of us involved that it can still continue that.
I don't know that the committee's actually made any recommendations to the commissioners yet. So it's possible that it's going
to. And so, I know Dwayne's here. Dwayne, you can step in anytime you want, but we had a great meeting last Friday with Dwayne, myself, and two of our commissioners. They reaffirmed their desire to continue working together as those two commissioners. They also asked to start scheduling quarterly bi-county meetings to have discussions about these joint county services. So I think there is a strong desire for the two commissioners to work together. County grows bigger, that there will be a need for them to stand up some services on their own.
Someday.
and I know what, I mean, I'm a Franklin County resident, have been for almost 20 years, and I recognize that someday those services need to be over there, but we don't have financial, or Franklin County doesn't have the financial ability to stand those up today. And I'd rather have services for my county today shared with someone else with no capital investment. That if I say, hey, 10 years from now, I have the money to stand up my own crisis facility, cost nothing except for what it costs to have me for the season. So that, to me, makes total sense. And I get it. There's some conflict of interest for me because I work for Benton County, but I live in Franklin County. And really, I do want the best for Benton County.
Well, I think to piggyback off of that, even the consumers, the clients that will be accessing this, they don't see it as a Benton or Franklin County issue. It's a, you know, it's not even, it's, that's not, they'll see, you know, people live in Franklin County already receive services in Benton County and vice versa. So it's, I don't think from the consumer standpoint, I don't think it's an issue.
But at the end of the day, it's not a county, it's a behavioral health issue, and we most counties.
Thank you.
It's just as bad. You know, there's politics in this world, and Frank, I absolutely hate them, but it is what it is. We've got to just find the best way to help.
Dan, I think to answer, I think the quarterly bi-county get-togethers are good, and maybe that would be a good opportunity for a couple of representatives from this group to come back and report what we've talked about. I do talk to our commissioners about what's talked about it in this group, and let them know what's going well and what we're doing. But it wouldn't be bad to have that quarterly if we do it every other meeting. But I think you're going to see hopefully from both sides of the river at these bi-county meetings, is that there is that desire to work together and to continue to look. You know, I mean, we all know what in this room, these facilities, they're going to fill up pretty quick. There is absolutely going to be a need as this population grows for more of these facilities, and there's no reason those shouldn't go on the other side of the river. It's just to, you know, let's get what we can today and plan for the future.
I think we're very much past due for a bi-county meeting to get consensus. We're speculating. A lot of times things have kind of gone to speculating to the negative. And I think it's been very good that we get the counties together, discuss this to really, so we can have something concrete. Personally, I think it's going to be very, I hope so.
Thank you for the
this is Erin Petty again, and I'm thank you for bringing this up because it was on social media. First, when I read it, my heart was in my throat, but this is normal. This is a part of healthy group formation, and that's what we're a part of. This kind of begs to a topic we talked about last month about who's to speak for the group and how that information should get out to the public. And I will say, when we talked about it last month, I felt like, I am not prepared to be a spokesman for the group because I just don't feel like I know all of the ins and the outs. I don't know exactly where all the funding is coming from. I don't know where exactly where the planned resources are to go to. Although I am passionate, I am 100% involved. I would not be a good spokesman coming from a large agency in Oregon. Our organization kind of had that planned in who speaks to the media. And we had a certain group of people that if we were approached by the media or if we were to speak on social media, that we directed people that were inquiring about what we were doing, that they would be the spokespeople. And really, they were equipped to answer. And I guess I would propose that maybe we think about that for this group. Because I don't know. I mean, I'm speaking for myself, but I'm not really equipped to speak all the ins and the outs, and I would not be a good spokesman at this point. And that's just something to consider for this group as we become more exposed.
Oh, we have Matt and Shaggy and Kyle.
I think at least initially, typically on a committee like this, the chairman is usually the main spokesperson. Sorry, BJ, but
I was about to say that in the bylaws it says that the chairman is the spokesperson.
We do have the communication subgroup, and that would probably be a good thing for them to work on, is to come up with a more of a communications procedure or plan or policy of, you know, how are these things handled, who do these questions get directed to, and so.
I think that would be a good for that group to meet. I'm willing to meet with that group. It's all rolling on.
Well, it might be helpful, I think, to maybe let the media give them updates. I think in the lack of information, people tend to create their own, and it's sure was accurate. And so I think public interest in this, and I think, you know, maybe there hasn't been a whole lot to inform them on today, but I think moving forward there will be, and so I think having having those contacts would be helpful to get that word out in a positive manner. And
she's garner a lot of attention, and she sent it out to all of her contacts. She does a media release for us, and my phone started blowing up, and talking to news stations, newspapers. That's a quick way to get information out.
Building that network. Say anything.
Yeah, just as I was going to mention it under other business, but now's a good time. I will be with the county for 2 more weeks. We'll be taking a role at Franklin PUD. So it's a good opportunity. It's bittersweet for sure, but yeah, no, I'm more than happy to continue working with county and other members of this committee to make sure that this project maintains success and keeps moving forward, because I think that's an important thing regardless. But yeah, the media contacts list that I have is pretty comprehensive and wide reaching. So that's definitely something that I would be passing on to the rest of the communications committee, subcommittee group. To make sure that they have all of that contact information. I would recommend too that maybe this is a role for Benton County and Franklin County to invite members of the public that you know are interested, or other media agencies, to the committee meetings. These are open meetings to the public. I think that they're great for discussion. And especially as we get to a point of moving forward on getting services stood up, that's going to be something that the community and that the media is very interested in. So.
Do we come back to that other business?
All right, moving on to the next item on the agenda, it's an opportunity for public comment. Anybody would like to share anything with the committee? This would be the time to do that. Both on the foster parenting side as well as the actual licensing of the.
Yeah, we had specific.
Lori, thank you. Anyone else?
Should for the new RP and what I'm hearing is pure detox, ENT slash crisis unit. That 16 beds, 20 beds, 20 recliners. 16.
Yep.
That's remind me the size of that. Square foot.
It's 22,000 square feet, but it could be almost double. There's enough room, and it wouldn't be difficult to add a second story inside. So it could go up to about 40,000 square feet, or anywhere in between those two numbers.
Yeah, my. That typically decide on that 16 bed ENT unit, 2 units plus suites. Start talking about laundry facilities and kitchen facilities, shrink rooms and requirements for how big spaces have. Just mention that.
Kitchen and laundry. We talked.
Yeah, I mean, have a kitchen and laundry.
We'll have to. That's part of why we got to get a provider in there and decide how many beds we can fit.
Yeah.
So the RFP just said that's we desire 16, but if the answer comes back that it can only fit 12 of each or 16 of one, and those are decisions that'll have to be made at 12 of them.
Any other comments?
Assumption. I'm Jerome Delvin, and I just wanted to say, Matt does keep us up on what's going on, but I just wanted to thank all of you for taking the time to be on this advisory group, because start first talking about that. I don't want this to be county driven service. I want it to be a community driven service. And that's why I wanted the advisory committee set up for both counties. I just want to thank you for your time. Just to help both counties get this thing moving.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, any other business? I entertain a motion that Cheyenne cannot quit.
Do you have a replacement already?
Call the vote.
Yes.
You're not. But I tried. Any other business?
So, do we do public comment?
Yes.
Okay. So the question I have is, when we talk about our work groups, at the meeting of the work group, when we were having some discussion about, you know, pulling together one of the communications work groups, and now we're losing one of our key players there. And so trying to get a handle on if we have a lead designated, that's one of the questions I have, is if we have somebody who's going to be working to pull folks together about that topic. And the second question I have is, I didn't officially ask this, although we had some chatter about it at the last meeting. There are more people wanting to have conversations beyond just communications about the recovery center, where we're talking about behavioral health overall. And community perceptions and things like that. And so my question is, when we have work groups of the advisory committee, no matter which one of them it is it an option to bring in non-advisory committee members to support the work groups, assuming they're not obviously advisory committees? The information would be inform the work groups.
That would be an issue.
Okay.
I think it would not only be advisable, but recommended.
Okay.
Yes.
We're all on board with that.
I think that was the purpose of the work groups, was to be able to reach out to these other, you know, workforce education, is engage with the colleges and people and bring that information back. And that is the intent.
Great question.
Any other business? All right, we are getting done 5 minutes early. So we adjourn. Post. Unanimous consent, so this meeting is adjourned.